Ken Loach has been described as the most left-wing, the most subversive director Britain has ever had. His latest, I, Daniel Blake, won the Palme d'Or at Cannes last year, making Loach not only the oldest winner, he was 79 at the time, but also, I think, the first director to win it twice, the first time with The Wind That Shakes the Barley in 2006. Loach has made 26 features in over 50 years. I, Daniel Blake, is the most commercially successful. It's a passionate denunciation of the petty bureaucratic humiliations doled out by the British welfare system. And next month, if you have the Rialto channel, you can see I, Daniel Blake, as well as a new documentary called Versus, The Life and Films of Ken Loach. I asked him how he felt being the subject of a film himself.
It was very strange, really, seeing yourself on the screen. It's very difficult for me to judge. I was watching it through my fingers for me.
I can imagine. But it was all good in the end, and I think that it gave people a much better understanding of you than they would have had previously, perhaps, because I think people imagine you as some kind of firebrand shouting at the world, when in fact you're a lot more subtle than that, aren't you?
Well, I'd hope so. I mean, you wouldn't get very far if you were just a megaphone, would you? I think the film was very nicely done, and she's a very, you know, generous filmmaker. I slightly wish there'd been more about the group of us who make films, and maybe more about the films I've done with Paul Laverty, the writer, which have been the majority of stuff we've done really for the last over 20 years now. So we're a kind of couple like Morecambe and Wise now.
I'll talk a bit more about Versus later, if you don't mind, but I want to go back to Kathy Come Home, 1966, an electrifying effect on Britain. I was a child at the time. I remember watching it. It's right. The first thing I ever remember, serious drama ever remember watching on television. 12 million people watched that, and it made a difference, didn't it?
Well, it made a little difference at the time. But, of course, the problem of homelessness is worse now than it ever was because we can't exaggerate the effect of a TV program. What it showed was a family split up because they got nowhere to live, and the children were taken away and the mother and the father split up. And because of that, they did agree, local authorities agreed, that they would house the husband with the rest of the family, and that was a good thing. But, of course, the problems of homelessness come from a market economy in housing, and it's beyond a television program to deal with that. You need a political movement, and you need an analysis that deals with how you establish a planned economy as opposed to a market economy, because a market economy will produce people with nowhere to live. So, in a way, that was beyond the possibility of a TV program to solve.
No, I suppose when I say it made a difference, I meant that organisations were set up to help the homeless. But the difference you want to make is that there would be no more homeless.
Yes. Well, who said charity is justice delayed? And I think, you know, when charities have to be set up, it's a mark of how society's failed.
Mm. It certainly disturbed the critics who didn't understand the realism, the docudrama nature of it, which now has become relatively common, but in those days was not.
No, I don't think it's that common even now. I mean, I think drama by and large, there's some good writers always, and there's always good directors, and there's always good actors. But I think the management is much more safety orientated, and things are micromanaged to a much greater extent. I mean, people didn't know what we were doing until they saw the finished product. Now, there are people watching it at every stage and making suggestions at every stage when they're not part of the production. So the micromanagement is what kills originality.
In Versus, Tony Garnett, I think, tells a story. Your former colleague Tony Garnett tells a story about you and he going to see the Minister of Housing, presumably.
Yes.
Lobbying him to do something about the homeless, and he wrung his hands and said, "But what can one do?"
Yes.
And what did you say?
Yes. Well, I mean that was. That was the problem, really. We thought that obviously they had to tackle the market in housing. You know, that a market economy will produce homelessness because it won't plan jobs and homes and all the social infrastructure you need together. It'll just let the market try and sort it. Well, the market doesn't. And so, of course, you get work and no houses, and you get houses and no work. And that's what we've got now. Big increase in the homeless population. But no, that was the failure of a Labour government that tried to operate a capitalist economy and failed dismally.
Is it possible to see Daniel Blake, as some people have, I think, really, as an attack on the state welfare system as opposed to an attack on the way it has been run?
I suppose it's an examination of a government that uses poverty as a weapon. We've lived with mass unemployment and poverty since Thatcher was elected in 79, and to various degrees. And the mass unemployment is now turning into the working poor. So more people are working, but they're in poverty. They're not able to earn a wage that will sustain them and their families. And so there's a huge number of people who can't survive unless they have some help from the state. I mean, they just physically can't feed themselves. And so the state, and in the person of the present government, has tried to set up a system in place which is guaranteed to make people fail. I mean, if you don't fill in this form exactly correctly, if you get the buses late or you're 2 or 3 minutes late for an appointment, your money will be stopped. And when your money is stopped, you either have to eat or you don't pay the rent or what happens, and you're in serious trouble. And that's the system they've created in order to show that poverty is the fault of the poor, or if you haven't got a job, it's your own fault, you're incompetent, when, of course, there aren't enough jobs or enough jobs that will pay a living wage to go around. And this determination to punish the poor for their poverty is what lies at the heart of the system that they put in place.
You announced your retirement in 2014, although I think that you suggested there was some ambiguity about what you were retiring from. And then the Conservatives won the election and you came out of retirement to make Daniel Blake.
Oh, well, it's neat.
Not quite like that.
Well, not quite, no. I mean, we were doing a film in Ireland. I'd been away a long time and... you know, when you're knocking on a bit, you think, well, this is daft. And so I thought, well, I'm not going to get through this. And I said, look, I don't think I'll do one after this. But then you finish, you come home, you know, you stay at home for a bit and you think, well, I've got to get out and do something again. So we did another one and just keep going, really.
I'm thinking that if you had retired, then Grenfell Tower and the dreadful fire in that might have brought you out.
Well, I mean, I think, I don't think it works quite like that, really, because, I mean, we're not journalists. I mean, Paul writes fiction and I direct them and Rebecca produces them. I mean, we don't really chase headlines. I mean, it's not journalism and, you know, there are many other good journalists who do that very well. I suppose what we always look for is a story that tries to say... reflect on the way we live together, reflect on how we treat each other, reflect on the consequences of that for our families, for our relationships, for how we survive, you know, the people we become, whether we become the people we could become, really, the choices people face. So that it should be much more about just the connection between who we are, our potential, the raw material of our character and the society we live in and how the two interact and the one shapes the other. So it's not a question that, oh God, there's a tragedy, we must make a film about it. I mean, it's in a way that it should be much more nuanced than that.
Yes, although it seems so dramatically emblematic of everything that you have been saying for your entire career, really.
Well, I think it's a terrible monument to this and preceding governments that they've let the market rule. And so the rich have got richer and the poor have got poorer because the rich, the big corporations, in their competitive struggle with each other, have to get the cheapest labor they can. If they get the cheapest labor, they're putting people out of work. They're using the new technology to reduce the workforce. That means they've got a pool of labor who will do the work for very little money because everybody needs some to survive. So it's reducing the cost of labor and it's reducing the power of labor all the time. And therefore people are disregarded. They have no economic or little economic power, so it doesn't matter how you treat them, because what can they do? So they're put in tower blocks that are a danger. And it needs a terrible tragedy like the one we saw for people to realize, my God, well, what are we doing to people? Well, it's been known, you know, they knew it. The residents were saying this is a fire trap, but of course the council, which is a right-wing council, and the government, which is a right-wing government, took no notice.
I'm talking to Ken Loach, director, most recently of I, Daniel Blake. So how did you become politicised? As we know, you were brought up in a Tory working-class family. You read the Daily Express in your parts, and then you went...
Yes, it wasn't a fiercely Tory family at all. I mean,
no, by default, I suppose, in those days, was it?
Yes, yeah. I mean my dad was a factory worker who did reasonably well and became in charge of a gang doing maintenance and sort of progressed up that ladder. But he was a working class man all his life, really, in his attitude and everything. But he read a right wing newspaper, and that was the one that came into the house. I mean, most newspapers are, as you know. The Express came into the house, and so I absorbed that. But then, I did national service. I was in the Air Force. You suddenly start to see life. Went to university and saw people who were seriously rich.
Well, you went to Oxford, more to the point.
Yes, yeah. I mean, the gilded youth, you know, who knew they were going to inherit the earth, as indeed they did. And then I started work in the 60s, 1960. And the 60s was a very political time. There was the student movement, there was the anti-Stalinist left, the Trotskyist left, which defended the gains of the October Revolution in Russia, but was vehemently opposed to the oppression of Stalin. And that was the current of politics that many of us were drawn to, because it was anti-capitalist, but it wasn't pro-Soviet Russia. And there were many shades of that and many different groups. But arguing through those ideas, testing them against one another, reading the books, seeing how they were used in action, I mean, that was a very politicizing decade, culminating in 1968 with the student movement and the events in Paris and then the factory occupations in France and in Britain too. So that there was a sense of a political turmoil, and there was a core of ideas that we fought for and analysed and challenged and tried to hone, really, in argument. And I guess that's the basis of the ideas that I've stuck with ever since.
There's Gabriel Byrne in Versus, the documentary about you, who was the star, of course, of The Wind That Shakes the Barley, which was your first big win at Cannes. He says, in admiration, that what makes you great is the intractable, unchanging nature of you, that your views then are your views now. That's a good way of saying that you're incredibly stubborn. Well,
there's, if you think it's a bad, you say stubborn. If you think it's good, you say principled.
Of course.
I mean, it's probably a mixture of the two, isn't it, really, like most of us.
Do you think you've changed your position on anything?
Well, I think the basic principles stay the same. You know, once you've read Darwin, you wouldn't suddenly change the basic principles, would you? I mean, the basic principle of evolution is evolution. That's it. The basic principle of a capitalist economy is a struggle between capital and labour. That's immutable. I mean, that's the nature of the beast. But how you interpret that, how that struggle has developed, how capitalism has adapted itself, how labour has been let down by a leadership that has tried to make capitalism work, or a leadership that's sold out in the interests of Soviet Russia, or whatever. I mean, whatever reason. I mean, that you, all the time you are, refining the ideas and seeing how they play out in current society. But the core idea, the core principles, you wouldn't change, because it's like the principle of the internal combustion engine. It works in a certain way, and the economic system works in a certain way. But it's adapted and changed like the motor cars change.
But you still believe that there are those two forces opposing each other?
I think, yes, of course. And
I mean, I wondered whether it's really,
you do,
really such a dichotomy. I mean, does insisting on this versus that, bad versus good, I mean, that's why the documentary is called Versus, but insisting on that dichotomy and a polarity, does that not ensure that the polarity continues?
No. It's the only way you can change it. If you pretend, as social democrats do, they say, you know, well, we can make the system work for us. Margaret Thatcher said there's no such thing as class, while mounting a vicious attack on the working class.
Well, did she say there's no such thing as class, or there's no such thing as society?
No, I think she said we're all working class now. While attempting to destroy trade unions,
right?
I mean, but I think that the I mean, obviously Tories are Tories, and they promote the interests of business and big corporations. I think our biggest struggle has been with those who claim to represent labour, but in fact represent capital, and that's been the problem for the last century, really. The those who pretend to be on the left say, well, the fundamental flaw is this, Kim. Their argument is based on the fact that the employer has to make a profit first. Okay, they believe in the market economy. They believe in private industry. For that to succeed, they have to be successful. For them to be successful, they have to make a profit. For them to make a profit, then they have to have labor that they can afford. That means that if you're a worker, you can't defend your job unless the employer is making a profit. You can't get a wage increase, or you can't avoid a wage cut unless the employer is making a profit. So labour is then tied to the interests of capital. But of course that doesn't work, because capital is full of swings and roundabouts, and say we've been through mass unemployment and mass poverty, and Daniel Blake is an example of how poverty, desperate poverty, hunger, is used as a weapon against the working class, the workers who have no work.
You left the Labour Party under Blair. Have you rejoined it under Jeremy Corbyn?
Well, I have it, yes.
I thought you might.
Much to my surprise.
Why?
Much to my surprise.
Why to your surprise?
I think Jeremy has Corbyn and John McDonnell, who's a very important figure too. For the first time, I think, maybe the first time in the history of the Labour Party, I'm not sure about that, but it's possible. For the first time, they stand with the interests of workers rather than employers. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn, as leader, has stood alongside workers on picket line. Never happened before, to my knowledge. I mean, others may be able to prove I'm wrong, but as far as I know, it hasn't happened before. They would cut back the power of big corporations. They would remove them from the health service. At the moment, a lot of health work is carried out by corporations like Virgin, for example. You know, big health, private health corporations are now doing part of the work of the National Health Service. They run the train. Private companies run the trains. Labour under Jeremy Corbyn would remove them from that. They'd remove them from some of this energy supply industry. They would, in terms of housing, they would fund municipalities to build houses again rather than the big companies. So they would seriously cut back the power of big business. Now, that's a substantial change. And I think it's necessary, because apart from anything else, it means that that people get paid a proper wage, that the wage differentials would decrease, that we could take care of people's health without having to pay profits to big business. And if we want to safeguard the environment, which is the biggest question of all, I mean, it's the elephant in the living room, isn't it? Are we going to have a planet to hand on to our grandchildren, great-grandchildren and the rest? If we want to do that, we've got to plan how we use the resources. We can't plan it if we don't own the resources. So in a way, I think there's an end game now that we never knew of in the 60s, that's for sure.
The operative,
so I think for all those reasons, I think Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell are really good news.
The operative word in all that, of course, is would, and Mr. Corbyn has still got to get into power. And yeah. So disunited does the party seem, and so unlikable do so many members of the Labour Party seem to find Jeremy Corbyn that seems unlikely.
I don't know where you get the information from.
Ah.
I mean, he's been elected by more, the biggest margin of any member, of any leader.
Yes, I mean, of course.
When he became leader, there were 200,000. There are now nearly 600,000.
No, I was referring to the parliamentary party.
Because of him. Well, that's a couple of hundred.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the overwhelming majority support him. And of course, he did very well in the election. He didn't win. But the problem is the MPs, and you're right to highlight it. And if those MPs stay in place, attacking him in public, briefing against him to the press, writing articles for the right-wing press, attacking him, if that continues, you've got a point. Very hard to win. I mean, he did well despite that. He won seats despite that in the last election, despite all the attacks from the party in Parliament. But you're right, those MPs have got to be changed if we're going to really make the changes that we need.
The wilderness years you talk about in the documentary versus Thatcher came in, the climate changed, you couldn't get your work accepted, you had the terrible loss of your son in the car accident. And of course you did something that you say you're ashamed of now, and did that advertisement for McDonald's and the advertisement for Nestle.
Oh God, yes, don't remind me.
Nah, but actually the clips of those ads, I mean, I'm sure this doesn't console you, but they were fabulous advertisements.
Well, I thought I was bad at them. I was hoping I was bad. I mean, because one thing I learned is that when you're doing a commercial, and I only did them for 2 or 3 years, thank goodness. But when you're doing a commercial, the one thing you cannot say, you can't challenge the research, which is what you're doing when you're doing a film. You know, you're challenging what you're finding all the time to make certain you've got it right. But then, you know, I'd go to a meeting with the agency and the people who were selling what we had to promote, and they'd say, well, you know, these are the people who buy the stuff or whatever. And I'd say, well, how do you know? And it says in the research, well, just say, can I see it? Well, of course, you know, a lot of black looks went around. I was kicked under the table. So don't challenge the research. Just point the camera. I mean, lots of funny things happened in that. I mean, I discovered, is there time for this?
Of course.
I mean, I discovered that the one thing you don't, when you've got a day to shoot something, to a commercial, you've got to make certain you fill out the day. I mean, we did a little commercial in the in a very beautiful part of the country, on the border country with Scotland, and it was very simple. And we'd filmed it. We'd finished about 11 o'clock in the morning. It was only a few shots, but the agency hadn't arrived yet. And the agency, that's the people, our production company, who were looking after the advertising agency and also the people from whatever it is we were, the product. And they turned up about 12 o'clock in a fleet of cars, expecting to be entertained by watching the filming and then going to a very posh restaurant in the evening. And, of course, we were wrapping up. So we had to reshoot some of the shots just to pretend that we were still filming. I mean, you know, the thing is so just corrupt at a venal level, really. And it was a freebie, seen as a day out, you know, as a freebie. But, I mean, I wasn't very good at it, to be honest.
So staunch are you that people expect you to be, you know, constantly rigorous, which must be a burden. I mean, you know, the McDonald and the Nestle ads, needs must, but there you go. And there's a recent controversy about Israel. You took Radiohead to task for performing in Israel in breach of a cultural boycott.
I'm glad you saw that. Yes.
It turns out that your films, including I, Daniel Blake, have allegedly been very successful in Israel. And people are going, yeah, what are you doing, hypocrite?
Well, they didn't read the details of the boycott. But what the boycott, which is asked for by all levels of Palestinian society, and particularly academics and particularly Palestinian artists, and they say, don't do things that promote the Israeli state. Don't do personal appearances. Don't go to events where it is promoted by the Israeli state or has funding from the state. Don't try to avoid festivals or argue against festivals taking those films. And that's what we've done. We didn't say Radiohead's music shouldn't be played. Just don't do the personal appearance. That's all. But actually, since that, all the money from I, Daniel Blake in Israel, which is an additional thing to what the boycott asks, will go to Palestinian causes, including political causes. But that was a kind of mischievous article. I mean, other filmmakers who support the boycott, their films are shown. It's just they pick on me because they see I'm a target.
Well, they do, and it's not just the Daily Mail. You know, it's you are a kind of default target for everybody who wants to have a go at the left wing in some way.
Yeah, but of course, I mean, it's very important that we boycott Israel culturally because of the oppression of the Palestinians. I mean, they are thieving Palestinian land acre by acre with the settlements, taking away their territory. Oppressing them in their daily lives. It seems they can kill them with impunity, and it's intolerable. And the world, our country, the UK, sort of has our arms, deals with them. It's funded by the USA. So in a way, what can civil society do? And this is peaceful, it's completely nonviolent. It just says, look, we won't go and do personal appearances. And I think that because of what the Israeli state is doing. And I think that's an honourable way to try to deal with it.
Where are you on the optimism scale? You know, you've spent your entire life arguing these things on behalf of people, and everything seems to be getting worse.
Well, it depends where you stand, really. I mean, I think it's an ongoing struggle. Depends where what you read, depends where you go. I mean, I think in Britain, I think there's a huge upsurge of people who are saying we're not tolerating this anymore. So I don't think it is getting worse. I think it's a very dynamic political situation, very volatile. I mean, you've seen certainly the old right-wing Labour is having a hard time in Europe. You see what happened to Hollande. See what happened in the French election, see what happened to the Labour Party in Britain, lost three elections, but Jeremy Corbyn comes along, moves it substantially to the left and does very well. So I think it's dynamic, Kim, and I think things will... Well, the one thing we know, don't we, is that history doesn't stay still.
No. It does kind of eat itself, though. I mean, even you have described yourself as like a cork bobbing on the waves, and you ask yourself the question, is it worth it? And your answer is, you don't know.
I'm not. Well, if I said that, I wouldn't say that. No.
It was a low moment, was it?
I'm not sure where the quote comes from, to be honest.
From Versus.
Well, I mean, in a sense, you're cork bobbing. Well, I mean, I've got to clarify that, really.
Okay.
When you're cork bobbing on the waves insofar as you are... You're part of a tide, you know, to continue the watery metaphor. You're part of a tide that moves at you because of objective circumstances. You know, you're not King Canute who tries to stop it. You're a cork on that tide being carried along. But nevertheless, you can try and understand why the tide is coming in or if it's going out. What are the forces that are driving it? And to try to contribute to it, if, you know, contribute to its strength, contribute to its direction. I mean, there's great, I said, I think there's great frustration and anger about the alienation of people, and you saw that in the Brexit vote. A lot of people, they said we're not having this anymore, and took a vote against what they thought was the political establishment, and were located the source of their frustration in various ways. Now, I mean, if you can harness that into a productive way, and I think Jeremy Corbyn can do this, and is touching people, then it can be constructive. And you can use that sense of dissatisfaction to create something much better.
It seems an odd alliance. I mean, I can see what you're saying, but to ally Jeremy Corbyn with the Brexit voters, as we understand them to be, seems
unlikely. Well, it depends where you get information from, Kim, really.
Yes, exactly.
Because they're
portrayed, of course, as...
Yes.
Racist Little Britainers.
No, well, of course, that's. What do you mean? The Daily Mail was all the right wing press were pushing for it. I mean, they are the, and I think there's, you could quote headlines that show that the right wing press do promote racism, even if, you know, they would claim not to be racist themselves, but they have constant headlines about immigrants, constant headlines about people on. Getting social security to show that they're feckless, that they're scroungers. They promote this divisive attitude. But I think, well, there's a lot in what you've said, Kim. I mean, the Brexit vote, a lot of it, the majority of it was from the right wing. I mean, it was the Tory party, most of the Tory. The majority of those who voted to leave Europe were Tories. There's an element of Labour voters there, or people who would normally vote Labour, who from areas, mainly areas where the old industries have died, nothing been put in its place. Blair and Brown and co. didn't reinvest, as they should have done, the other Labour leaders when in power. So those Labour voters swung towards leaving Europe, but they weren't the majority, but they will come back to Jeremy Corbyn if his policy of investing in those areas with industries that will sustain themselves, will give proper jobs with a wage that you can bring up a family, then their interests are served by the party that should represent them, which is Labour. So it's a complex situation, really. And of course, it's caricatured and oversimplified.
I just wanted to talk to you for a moment about your modus operandi in your films that you've followed ever since the beginning, I think, that you shoot them in chronological sequence and you drip feed the actors their parts so that they are genuinely surprised. In Kathy Come Home, Carol White was genuinely astonished that her children were being taken away and subsequently was traumatized. To a convincing degree. You still do this. This is what you believe is the best way to get performances out?
Well, I mean, the way you put it, it sounds very cruel. Really.
Well, it was cool and it was... You know, in Cares, the children were beaten, as an example of your ruthlessness in verses.
I would say on that... Every day of the year in that school, kids they got caned across their hands, and every day a line of boys would be caned in that school. So all we did was repeat with the daily practice, I don't think he did it quite as hard. And the man who played the headmaster was a headmaster, and he caned boys. And I think it may just be that seeing that on the screen was a small part in getting caning stopped.
Yeah.
But in this case, instead of just going home wringing their hands, they got 10 bob each for every stroke, I think, or pretty much that. So they did actually get something out of it. And it wasn't quite as traumatic as it's... I mean, it looks traumatic now because we're in a different culture, but this is 50 years ago.
And also, you got an astonishing performance out of them. I mean, it's not always justified. No, you know, you couldn't say no children were harmed in the production of this movie, but they really did. You know, they had that, they were trying not to cry on their faces, which was extraordinarily effective.
Yes, there was one little boy, but I think he contributed to the greater good. I'd say, I mean, times change. I mean, you wouldn't do it now, obviously. But it's not happening in schools now.
So do you really think that that contributed to, in some way, to the demise of corporal punishment?
I can't say that. But there was a feeling, there was a starting to be a feeling that this was not right. And I think that, who knows, you know, it might have helped a little bit. May not have done, I don't know.
That was a lovely movie, Kez, and... I was interested to hear that nobody expected it to be successful. Somebody said it opened in 6 theatres in Yorkshire, expected it to disappear, and suddenly it took off.
The Americans, who backed it against their will, said that they understood Hungarian better.
Did you have to subtitle it for the Americans?
Yeah, they tried to change the words, but of course it didn't work. I think it was. I'm not sure the Americans ever saw it. We've never done very well in the States. I mean, I guess our films are very European in the way they're done.
Yeah. And do you mean bleak?
No.
When you say European?
No, not and the opposite of bleak. I think American films, commercial American films anyway, I mean, there's some very fine American filmmakers, but the mainstream commercial films, Hollywood, tends to be sentimental, tends to be violent, tends to be salute wealth without questioning where it's come from, promotes the U.S. as the source of peace and democracy and international cooperation and all that, when, of course, we know the opposite is the truth. So, I mean, I think it's Hollywood, by and large, is melodrama, and we've tried to be humane and realistic and humorous, but in a human way, not in a kind of melodramatic way.
The critics...
To try to. It's only an aim, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, we failed many times.
Some critics, who wholeheartedly applaud I, Daniel Blake, still say that you may have lapsed into melodrama at the end, or didacticism.
We didn't get those. Not many critics said that in Britain. I mean, they usually say that because they don't like the implications of the film. I mean, that's, you know, because the film leads you to certain conclusions, and they don't like those conclusions. So they say it's didactic. I mean, we have umpteen films about Churchill now. Now they won't be seen as didactic, although they'll present the old bruiser as a great man who saved his country. I mean, I'd challenge that interpretation, and many would. He was a class warrior and an imperialist and opposed giving independence to what he saw as colonies. But there won't be too much of that will come out. It'll be Churchill the hero. Now, they won't see that as didactic because they will, by and large, agree with it.
We've just had Boris Johnson visiting us.
Oh, God. Oh, never mind.
And I was just thinking, he's written a hagiography of Churchill. He thinks Churchill's the, you know, hero of every century. And it's very interesting to read it in the context of Boris Johnson's career now.
Yes. Well, he presents himself as a buffoon, but as somebody who you're meant to think is clever underneath. He may well be, I don't know. I mean, he stands for everything that many of us oppose.
Your son, Jim, is also a filmmaker in very much your footsteps, it seems to me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very proud of him. I'm very proud of all of our kids, you know, as everyone always is. And very proud of the films Jim has done. And he did some in... did two in Australia. And
Sunshine and Oranges.
Yes, yes.
Which
Oranges
was,
and Sunshine, yes.
Oranges and Sunshine, yes. Excuse me, which yes, was about yes. the hundreds of thousands of children deported to Australia. Tragic yeah. story.
Yeah.
And focused on Margaret Humphreys, who was an yeah. extraordinary woman.
I thought he did a lovely job, and I'm very proud of all of them, and certainly his work, and he's working away, and I think it doesn't really help to have your dad in the same trade, really. I think it might help at the beginning where somebody might give you a job as an unpaid runner, but once you've done that, I think it's a bit of a hindrance, because I guess the point in our business is to be able to strike out and be your own person, you know.
Have any of your children rebelled against you and taken to the right and become a banker or something?
No, none of them have done that. I mean, we had a very what's a normal family life? But I mean, just...
Well, a normal family would include some offspring who would say, you know, to hell with you, I'm going to join the armed forces or something.
Well, I'm not sure. No, it would be a bit extreme, that. No, I mean, we all get on and looked about. I mean, they went to school and I didn't bring work home. So it was a very fairly relaxed family, and they all do good things now, and very happy with them. We all are.
I was
disappointed.
No, I think that's that's both unusual and creditable. Your wife Leslie says an interesting thing about you in Versus, and I wondered what your response to it was. She said you were the kind of actor when you started out in the theatre that you wouldn't dream of employing.
I think that was the unkindest cut of all. Really?
Really?
I think. Well. I mean, yes. I thought I was going to be, up there in lights. But I'm afraid the rest of the theatrical world had a different view. So I stopped being an actor quite quickly.
But her explanation of
no great loss to the profession,
and a great gain to the rest of the industry. But her explanation of that was interesting. She seemed to suggest that your intellect always took a step ahead of emotion, whereas what actors need to do, and what you demand actors do, is have the emotion always taking that first step.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe. I mean, I used to enjoy it a lot, but obviously didn't communicate that enjoyment to the audience. Anyway, but it was a nice, you know, it's a nice thing to do when you're young.
Well, there is yet time.
I love actors.
There is yet time.
Well, I don't know. No. If they're looking for an old hectoring octogenarian.
No, and that was Ken Loach, whose movie I, Daniel Blake, and also a documentary about him, Ken Loach himself, both are screening on Rialto Channel next week.